Francisco, California, USA. Looks down from Chinatown over a foggy bay. You travel there in a trolley, in a trolley up you climb. Dong dong, you're in Hong Kong, having yourself a time. You can eat if you are in the mood. Shark fin soup, bean cake fish. The girl who serves you all your food is the mouser tasty dish. You know you can't have a new way of living till you're living all the way on Grand Avenue.
Where is that?
San Francisco, that's where it's at. California, USA. A western street with eastern manners, tall pagodas with golden banners, throw their shadows through a lantern glow.
Good morning, and thanks for tuning into APA Compass, a monthly Asian and Pacific American public affairs program. On today's show, we'll hear perspectives on the consumption of Asian products and trends. Are these indicators of sincere cultural appreciation or consumerism at its worst? For example, when we buy Buddha statues for our house, garden, or office, is this complemented with a thorough understanding of Buddhism and the culture from which it came? Or is it buying into the pop culture myth of exoticism and good luck? And are we taking into consideration where these products come from and the people who make them? From Asian-themed decor and feng shui to geishas and sushi, where is that fine line? APA Compass Collective members Pam Fon and Jay Sablong asked a few local vendors to talk about some of the Asian products they sell and why they sell them. Please join us later as the collective talks about our own perspectives on this issue of cultural appreciation versus cultural appropriation.
As a merchant here on Hawthorne, what draws your interest into like Asian style furniture items to sell in the store?
I'm drawn to Asian art due to like the color and the architectural, because you mentioned furniture, and I am definitely drawn to that style because the color, the lacquer, and on a personal level, I'm drawn to the imagery like Buddhas or like Kuan Yin to be specific, because they're beautiful and the religious aspects are very open-minded. It seems like our Thai Buddhas are very popular images that we have. We have very large sculptural pieces and they're gold-leafed. A lot of people buy those for their own altars or like a garden space.
Because it's such a classic style that it maintains throughout trends, like something with a more retro theme may be out next season. However, the Asian theme has maintained for such a long time, and it's such a classic and diverse at the same time design, and there's so much you can do, and there's so many sects of the Asian cultures that have their own beautiful artwork, that it kind of incorporates itself into style and homes, and I have an Asian-themed bedroom.
What's in your bedroom?
I have some Asian watercolor paintings. I have lotus flowers. I have a Chinese screen.
Well, I like the Japanese like looks, where it's very sleek and stylish. I think it's pretty cool. Like, I mean, I like the looks. I was born here, raised here, so it's kind of foreign to me, too. I'm Chinese.
Well, personally, my house, I like decorating with things of different cultures, whether it's because I admire what it looks like or I'm interested in studying other cultures or the respect for other cultures. And I think having, whatever it be, whether it's furniture, clothing, textiles, whatever, art from any culture is significant, but I also think it's important to maintain culture. And I think for a lot, I just don't like the way the world's been westernized.
You know, I hadn't thought about it before, but a lot of the Asian, like the Asian cards are really popular, and like I'm thinking about Me So Pretty. I never thought about it before.
Oh, there's a product called Me So Pretty?
Yeah.
Can you guys talk about that?
It's our best-selling bath and body product.
Does it have miso in it?
No, it's got bamboo and lemongrass in it, though. Pomegranate. Yeah, it's just the line name, but it's our best-selling line because people see the packaging, which is very bright, very, like, Japanese cartoony in some aspects of it. And it's just their culture is so, has influenced the art so much that people love it.
We live in Indonesia. Yeah, my wife's Javanese. Yeah. So, yeah, we actually work with real people, families, our neighbors. And we put money into the hands of the people who actually do the work. But 85% of it is what I do and what my wife and I do. So we're living in Asia, and Made and his wife and their five family members, a couple uncles, and maybe a couple neighbors, they make the mosaic mirrors. And they make ours now for 9.5 to 10 years. Okay, his family's been making this particular item.
So yeah. What's the percentage of, in terms of profit for the artisans? What percentage of profit that they receive?
Okay, what we do is we pay for the labor.
Okay.
So we're not getting the items, selling them, and then coming back.
Okay.
What we're doing is we're basing our pay level on 20 to 25% above what they would get if they were either working at a factory or doing some other similar job. There's a factory that makes mosaic mirrors like the ones I have. And I know, and in fact, their wholesale price is probably cheaper than I can produce them for. Over half the products that I have are probably products that you could just as easily lay on the beach and drink your Mai Tais and order from a middleman at the same price or cheaper. Because the workers are not making enough money.
Okay, I have a theory. I've been in this business for 16 years. So right after the 80s when everybody was really into, like, you know, making lots of money and stuff. And then it was, like, all about the moons and stars and enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm thinking that people are really attracted to, like, Buddhism and Eastern religion kind of. It's a spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
But people aren't necessarily being specifically spiritual, but there's an overall
connection.
There's an overall spiritual feeling about it. And people are attracted to Buddhism, essentially the Asian influence, without necessarily being a Buddhist or getting into Zen or whatever, but they're attracted to that, and they're attracted to that way of thinking, and they're attracted to that kind of art because it brings up those kind of feelings.
It's good and bad to me in a way, where I think a lot of cultures are just becoming more like a prop or a background. I mean, how many people are actually aware of what it is they're purchasing? Which is okay if you buy something just because what it looks like. But I think if you are going to decorate your house with things, say, I was raised Catholic, and I'm not Catholic, but I flirted with Buddhism and Catholicism and other things. I have different deities all over my home, and I feel that I should be educated about what they are. So if someone from said culture comes over and asks me a question about a particular piece in my house, I should know a little bit more about it than, well, I liked how it looked.
A lot of times we'll have statues or imagery that we like, and people just slowly learn about them, or we find out something's popular, so we'll get those images again. And we also have little sheets that we put out, information sheets, so we can teach people about the religion or the iconography or where it's from or what it means.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what we want to represent is like the history of a culture and like the antiques, the history, the religion, the images, opposed to plastic kitschy things that are just in the moment. And we're a little more serious.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, you know, all aspects of items, like, you know, cute plastic things and keychains, but we definitely want to feature, like, history.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what excites me, is knowing, like, the roots and the culture and the timeline of these cultures.
Mm-hmm.
We like to feature, like, really spectacular oddities here, things that people aren't going to find anywhere else in the States, and that can be kind of a draw to us. Last summer we had a Shiva statue, which is Hindu, and it was over 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
The other day a woman came in and she wanted to buy a present for her acupuncturist and wanted it for this woman's office. But she didn't want to, like, have a really strong message behind this piece, more general and soothing. And so we were recommending like maybe a Buddha or a Kuan Yin because of what they represent and how like all-encompassing they are, and like a goddess of compassion and working in, you know, acupuncture. And we felt like that was a good suggestion, and she went with that.
Which are your favorite items in the store and why?
And why? Yoshitomo Nara, Japanese artist, we've carried for a bit of time, and he's very, very popular. We try to carry as much of his, I guess, retail stuff as we can. We have T-shirts that are designed by him, his art pieces, and then he came out with journals and calendars and postcard sets and stuff, and those just do great. Mm-hmm. You know, no one had heard of Yoshitomo Nara 2 years ago, mm-hmm. even though he's been producing art for 15 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's always kind of fun to see, just kind of get it out there in mainstream. Mm-hmm. Some of the stores on Hawthorne and some of the stores in Alberta just carry just different things. There may not be 20 of them, but that's kind of how we want to market them. You know, they're special and they're different, and so I mean it is kind of like the newer version of pop culture, just images. I mean, sushi on Band-Aids, I mean, who would have thought, you know?
Good morning. This is APA Compass. You're joining us at 9:16 a.m. And today our program is I Heart Orientals, Cultural Appreciation or Theft. First, we'd just like to tell you at 10 o'clock here, guests from Body Talk, a system of improved communication and synchronization within and between all elements of the body and mind for a better health. Good morning. You're joining us again. This is APA Compass. We're here in the studio with APA Collective members.
I'm Marie Lowe.
Liz Rogers. And we're talking about cultural appropriation. Soon we'll be opening up the phone lines. You're welcome to call at 231-8187 here at KBOO. And our first question for each other is... Do you have any comments about some of the snippets that we heard from the street?
Well, I think it's interesting the kind of the trend that I've noticed, I guess, in the last few years of whether it's feng shui or zen or, you know, just, you know, this mass marketing of, I guess, things that we would say like represent Asian or Asian-like culture. So I think it's, I don't know, it's interesting. It definitely raises a lot of questions. And I know for myself, it's figuring out where is that line? Am I mm-hmm. overreacting when I get really, you know, when I get really frustrated, when I see people buying certain things? No, you know, and I just assume that there's not, you know, a real appreciation or knowledge behind it, where it's just, oh, you know, it's really looks exotic, so I'm going to buy it mm-hmm. because I have the money to.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think I'm also very ambivalent about this kind of dynamic between, say, cultural appreciation or cultural appropriation. And, you know, maybe that's something we can also talk about, too. Like, how are we defining cultural appropriation? Because I think people sort of, you know, wouldn't really... debate over what is cultural appreciation, although I don't know, maybe someone would, I don't know. But I think in response to your question, Pam, about you know, responses to the snippets that we heard, what I think for me is somewhat problematic is the way in which the different histories, cultures, language, I mean, just all of that gets kind of homogenized under this general sort of oriental art or oriental fashion or style. And I think that there are real consequences and problems with that. So one, this kind of homogenization, you know, sort of feeds into that stereotype, all Orientals or all Asians look alike, and, you know, and of course oftentimes the default is Chinese, you know, and it just completely erases all of those different histories. But yeah, it just feeds into this kind of homogenization. So that's something that I think is one aspect of it that I find kind of problematic. Mm-hmm. What about you? Well, you bring up an interesting question about how do we define appropriation, and that's something that's really difficult in general. And so I'm asking you guys, how would you, not necessarily just how we would define appropriation, but I think maybe it starts with the term commodification, like the idea of turning something into a product. I don't know how you guys feel about
that. Yeah, oh yeah, and I think it's bound up with, I mean, not just turning in something into a product, but who profits from that product. Right. You know, where does the money for the materials, the labor, all those things, where does it end up, you know, in whose hands? And who gets to profit from, say, you know, quote-unquote celebrating or, you know, Asian culture? So I think it is bound up with commodification, and that's a question I think it's important.
It sounds like we have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Yes.
I wanted to say to the young lady that she shouldn't bother herself about that, because about what, you know, people's motives for buying stuff, because...
Why is that?
Because it's going to be done no matter what. That's the nature of the society that we live in, and in Asia also, you know. But what the other sister was saying about being more specific about where you direct, when I say you, I mean the people who traffic in, who deal in, who buy and sell Asian products, Asian ideas, not just Asian, but any group, you know. For instance, here in the United States, indigenous people have a really, they did have, and I think they still do have, a really well organized system of distribution, so that they can't be ripped off so much in the way that she's concerned about. I mean, all of the craftsmen.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying?
Thank you very much, caller.
Well, I would like to respond to that, because I do think that, one, we do can make ethical choices based on, you know, what we choose to support with our dollars. And so I think that it is important, actually, to be concerned about how people are spending their money, and also to hopefully inform people about the context and the perhaps different options and variables that are involved. You know, what are they supporting if they're just going to a store? I mean, it is kind of decontextualized. When you go to a store, it's all pretty and well lit, and, you know, and sometimes cutesy in relation to, say, Oriental stuff. So you kind of erase the history or just the process that led to that, the making of that product. So I actually would say that it is important to focus on, you know, what happens, how did it get there, and then also hopefully, you know, the more people know about these kinds of contexts and conditions, then hopefully the better and more informed choices. And, you know, I'm not saying that there's one right answer, but I do think that we do make choices, and we do make ethical choices when we go and buy something.
Yeah, I agree with what you say, and I think, you know, the caller was right in that people are just going to go out and buy, you know, essentially whatever they want. I think when we get back to the idea of what is appropriation, I mean, for me, it's taking something as your own, pretty much just because you can. And that's a lot of, you know, a lot of the consumerism around it is that, you know, I'm going to buy this because I can, not because I, you know, have a lot of knowledge behind it or practice it myself or, you know, but it's, so, I mean, I continuously, I think, struggle trying to find, draw the line for myself what I feel is, for me, okay and not okay.
We have another caller.
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
Good morning. Gordon Jones. Hey, listen, I was, as somebody who's lived in an Asian country for about 4 years, I was in that initial assembly of quotations that you had. I was getting steamed up and ticked off that there wasn't such a thing as Asian. And then I realized that you folks also are sort of irritated by that notion. But, you know, it is such a huge area of land with so many things going on, right from Korea in the north to Malaysia in the south and India in the west. And the more we can do to oppose the notion that there's an Asian thing, the better shape we're going to be in. Just parenthetically or as a side dish here, you know, George Bush thinks that there's a country called Africa. There really is. And so, I think people are going to be romantically and somehow nostalgically attached to the notion that Asian art and the Buddha and all of that brings one all sorts of solace. But I think the more we can hold on to the notion that we're dealing with a huge and varied land and population mass, and that to speak of there being such a thing as the Asian is simply disrespectful, I think we're going to be in good shape.
Yeah, right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, and I want to actually respond a little bit, or just comment about your point about this idea of romanticization of Asia, and you know, and I think that's totally right on, because you know, part of this romanticization, I think, is bound up with this idea that the, you know, Asia embodies some kind of exotic spirituality that defies sort of Western reason. And, you know, actually, Edward Said, this very influential literary and cultural critic, has talked about how basically this kind of fascination and romanticization with the East as, you know, mysterious, exotic, but heathen, feminized, passive, et cetera, actually supports and validates the West's conception of how it would like to see itself. So actually, this romanticization is really a reflection of how the West would like to define itself against this kind of mysterious spiritual East, so that it sort of supports this idea of the West as being civilized, progressive, right, not backwards in the way that, you know, like, how Asia, you know, or the Orient is so patriarchal, blah, blah, blah. We're much more liberated out here. And it really supports that kind of, you know, binary thinking that sort of puts the West certainly in a much better light, but also historically has rationalized colonization under this kind of noble, you know, project. So I just wanted to sort of elaborate on what that caller was saying. And
I think, excuse me, in overall, between the two callers that have commented about this question of bringing up the plurality of different cultures around the world, as well as kind of the persistence of capitalism or persistence of consumerism, I think the question for us here in the United States is ultimately, how do we define diversity? Because a lot of folks are saying, well, you know, we purchase these things because we're truly appreciating and we truly believe that we should appreciate other cultures, and they want to be more diverse in their lives, and they feel like they're educating themselves, which is a noble notion. But ultimately, we're talking about true systemic diversity overall. So if we're saying, you know, a consumer is completely willing to purchase a Buddha or purchase, you know, and participate in another culture, regardless of whether or not it's Asian culture, African American culture, indigenous culture, you know, et cetera, Latino, that ultimately are the systems matching that ideal.
Yes. Yeah,
so is
right.
The education system, the health care, right, all these systems, do they allow for that same type of diversity?
Right, right.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point, because I think diversity is a word that's really just thrown around quite easily. You know, I've had the opportunity to do a few diversity, what have been called diversity trainings, and it's really interesting because you know, we go in and we talk about basically, and we say that, you know, these are our perspectives on basically being an Asian and Pacific Islander American, and we are not representative of different, you know, marginalized groups. But it's crazy because people walk away from these diversity trainings thinking, now I'm so educated, but it's like, you know, we gave you like maybe 1/1,000,000th
right,
of really what is out there. And so I think, you know, getting back to, you know, the systemic issues of, yeah, if we were all really, really interested or really dedicated to this notion of diversity, we would really put more effort into, you know, systemic changes as opposed to what's on the shelves of the market.
Right.
Absolutely. We actually have prepared, throughout this program, we've kind of
thrown in music through the ages or through time, through recent history, modern musical history, about kind of different Asian-themed songs. So we have another one here for you. It's called China Girl by David Bowie. You're back with APA Compass, and just as a info for shows coming up, at 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, Lisa Lieberman, author of A Stranger Among Us, talks about in-home support for children with autism or spectrum disorder. And you're with APA Compass, and a caller just called and mentioned the reference that David Bowie is making in this song. And Marie, did you want to check in about that? Or
oh, well, I don't know, someone mentioned that it was something in relation to China White, which I have
heroin
to, yeah, so I didn't know about that. But I have to say, this song, when I was growing up, I was very happy to hear the song. I was like, oh my god, he's talking about me. I'm Chinese. But then as I grew up, I realized that might be actually really problematic. But I think that, you know, part of, I think, my excitement was bound up with the fact that there were no representations of any kind of Asian faces. So, you know, I was grateful for any kind, you know, and I didn't really obviously think very critically about that. But I think, you know, this is a roundabout way of getting back to, I think, a comment that you had brought up, Liz, which is about diversity and representation and, you know, how we presume somehow that people of color or an individual is somehow going to be representative or a spokesperson for a larger invisible group. And you know, and so when we think about diversity, you know, we just need a few food groups or representatives from that few food groups, and then that's it. And so, you know, what are the systemic issues that are involved in, right, the fact that there aren't a lot of you know, representations, and we only then sort of rely on these so-called representatives for that diversity. So I thought that was a very interesting point that you brought up.
And if you'd like to call in to speak with us, the number is 231-8187, and you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Well, I have a question for some of you, too. Like, you know, what do you think about specific examples of
cultural appropriation? I mean, we're trying to sort of define the term, and I think you had a very interesting perspective, Pam, about cultural appropriation.
Well, in general, it's been always really interesting because I feel like I'm kind of on a lot of levels bicultural for the purpose of, you know, I was born as an immigrant here in this country, and you know, there's definitely two worlds that I live in. I live in, you know, I'm with my family, we're speaking our language, we do our thing, and it's very much, you know, a Vietnamese world. And then, you know, when you step outside that door or go to school, it magically becomes the United States. And so I think when growing up and exactly how you responded to the David Bowie song, you know, as a child, like that idea of you're excited to see these representations. And I think immigrants really do feel as if they're being praised, or, you know, they appreciate and see sudden representation or sudden appreciation of who they are. And I think it depends on your perspective, especially if maybe you're, you know, maybe third or fourth generation Asian American and definitely identify as Asian American, versus if you've just come here and you definitely more identify with your Asian roots or your specific cultural roots. Actually, we have a couple of callers. We should go ahead and take one. Caller, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, it's a quick comment. I think that once cultural artifacts enter the realm of popular culture, they're sort of up for grabs, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And the way to avoid the worst of that is if you have an enlightened and curious population. You know, enlightened people will understand that a popular culture artifact isn't the whole story,
right.
And a curious population will want to dig into what is behind that. Like, a good example, the little book of Buddhism, you see that. That's obviously not the whole story, but someone might see that, get curious, and find out more. That's the best case scenario.
Thank you, caller.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, also, the issue is this disconnect from the people and the culture. You know, so in say, popular culture, an example is sort of like 19th century, 20th century interest in Oriental art. Well, at the same time, there's this great fascination with, you know, all things Oriental. There was a real anti-Asian sort of sentiment brewing here in the United States. Anti-Chinese exclusion laws, 1924 anti-Asian immigration laws, or anti-Asian immigration laws. So, I mean, that kind of disconnect between the people and then the culture, I think, you know, is part of the problem. And I think popular culture also sort of exacerbates that.
Well, I think you're making an interesting statement, because as you're talking about this disconnect between a culture and a people, I'm thinking as a Korean American adoptee, it's really interesting to, if you look at the numbers of children being adopted out of Asian countries as opposed to other countries. So where it's, and I don't know, I personally have my own opinion, you know, sense of certain dynamics that have been set up, but I think that's, you know, kind of an interesting phenomenon because, you know, Korea and China aren't the only countries that have, you know, I guess what people would call destitute children, or children in destitute situations. But for some reason, there's this very large, trendy attraction to, you know, and all good intentions. But I think there is something to be said for that trend versus, okay, how many kids are, like, right now, how many girls are being adopted out of China, and how many kids are being adopted, you know, out of some African countries.
Yeah.
We actually have another caller. Go ahead.
Oh, I actually wanted to maybe give you some ground on the other side of stuff, so someone that might be purchasing the some Asian culture things, but also
right.
I also like the food. I also have lots of friends that are Asian. My dad lives in the Philippines. My uncle's in Cambodia. And I probably will end up there for a long amount of time volunteering.
Great.
So I wanted to maybe give you ground on, I guess, a positive aspect. I'm not sure if commercialism is the main thing that got me interested at all. But I guess maybe give you a positive side of that. And also with adopting, I might end up doing that since I can't have children of my own as well. And if I do end up going there for a long amount of time.
Yeah.
And that is an interesting point you make about the ones that, the countries that might get neglected.
Right.
It's definitely important that they look at the needs and not the actual what they'd want to get out of adopting, because I really hear a lot of what they want to get out of adopting, and that doesn't seem to be the main point of it, really.
Yeah. Thank you very much, caller.
So actually, what is the positive aspects for you?
That does seem quite negative. I mean, but also in the Asian cultures themselves, do they have? I mean, when you go to Japan or something, right. do they have commercialism for their own country?
Yes.
So that would be an interesting point to make as well. What do they do in their own country? I mean, I know we have Uncle Sam. That's probably a stereotype, very right. terrible in maybe some Middle Eastern countries. I don't like the stereotype myself.
Yeah.
But that's also here in the U.S.
Oh, yeah. I think you're absolutely right that, you know, I mean, this idea of appropriation is not specific to one country or one place or one group of people. I mean, yes, Japan, you know, there is definitely a real sort of, U.S. culture is very much commodified and it's, you know, identified with hipness, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I think what, at least for me, I don't know if, you know, how Liz, you feel about this, or Pam, how you feel about this, but I think for me, part of the issue is not, you know, necessarily focusing on what's going on in all countries, which I think, I mean, in general, that is an important issue to look at, think about the dynamics, but I think in this particular conversation, at least what I'm trying to say is that, you know, how does that kind of commodification and appropriation impact Asian Pacific Americans living in the United States, you know, where there is this kind of general invisibility in terms of, say, political representation, you know, in terms of, say, just popular representations. So how it impacts people here, and then yet at the same time, there's this real kind of interest in, say, Asian culture or Asian pop culture, but it's at the expense of actually engaging with people who live here and are generally invisible. So that, I think, is the disconnect for me between the peoples and the culture. So that's sort of what I meant. I don't know what you think.
For me, I guess, I don't know if I went the extra step or if it just doesn't matter as much to me, since I have some friends from Indonesia. I'm interested in, you know, international relations and joining the international club and whatnot at my college. But there definitely is, I guess that would probably have, it would probably have a negative aspect for someone that was ignorant of a minority and then had, you know, of course, a stereotype of that minority.
Mm-hmm.
It would
mm-hmm.
definitely have a negative aspect as there's also, of course, with other different, minorities in the mm-hmm. past. I know also I'm a minority in some respects, being a Wiccan, I might have, I get lots of stereotypes as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
And some might say automatically that I'm evil, or some yeah. might like me right away for just because of what I believe in or practice.
Yeah.
I think you bring up a very good point, and thank you very much. Glenna Matsu, who's an Asian American studies professor in California, he talks about this question of he brings up an interesting question in the race discourse, and this includes, you know, all the different people who have the diasporas of people who have come to the United States, regardless of their racial or cultural background, about how whiteness in this country has become very blank mm-hmm. in terms of that because a lot of white folks are very far removed from their cultural roots, whether it be specifically somewhere in Europe or, you know, wherever, that there has been a phenomenon amongst white folks that because of this blankness that they can go kind of like walking through a grocery store. Actually, that's what he uses as his analogy, walking through a grocery store and just kind of picking things off the shelf. And that's, I think, what the larger concern as we talk about the race discourse, as we talk about kind of if we're really committed to this concept of diversity or committed to the question of quote-unquote, love, see no color, are trying to really get along within this country, which honestly here in the Americas in particular, and that includes Latin America and Central America, that, you know, we have very unique geographic populations or demographic populations because of colonization, because of, the transatlantic slave trade, things like that. So that race here is very, very much entrenched and complicated as opposed to other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as you're talking, Pam, I'm thinking, you know, because you're talking about, you know, some of the references to how people came here, you know, how, like, why we're so, like, I guess, and I'll use the word diverse, in the Americas, in, you know, the different, you know, group communities of people. And I think, you know, some would say, well, you know, that happened a long time ago, get on with it, you know, in around certain topics. But I think, again, getting back to the true, you know, a true commitment to diversity is that we really do have to take into, we can't just move on. We have to take into consideration, why are these things happening? Right. From what point did they happen? And how do we make this systemic change? How do we make, you know, how do we get, you know, role models for, you know, for the younger folks in our communities, whether it's, you know, people of color or other marginalized groups. I mean, how do we do that? Because, you know, I think we could, for the three of us, you know, we could talk about cultural appreciation versus cultural appropriation a lot. But we really, I think for people who say, yeah, I'm definitely dedicated to diversity and I want to respect other people's cultures, well, then let's do it in, you know, pretty much out in the open instead of going to the store and privately buying something and putting it in your house.
Right.
And I think that's, I don't know, that's kind of what I'm...
Yeah, and I think that's a larger discussion of power dynamics
right.
within this country as, you know, in regards to race
right.
or class, is that the folks who do have the relative power within the society, the question is, those of us who do need to really consider what it would be like if we were to give up some of that power,
right.
regardless of race or class or social station, things like that,
exactly.
things that do divide us.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, and I think that this idea, I mean, part of power and also who gets to do that, excuse me, and how oftentimes, I mean, this, and, you know, I'm using this word kind of, facetiously, I guess, but this idea of cultural tourism. I mean, we started with that song, you know, Grant Avenue, USA. It's like, you know, being able to visit another culture, either within your own sort of neighborhood, as in the case of Chinatown, or actually traveling, but that there is a certain kind of privilege embedded and bound up with being able to sort of partake and dip into another culture, and how that sometimes becomes, you know, sort of, I guess, a shorthand or a substitute for any kind of engagement with one's own privilege.
And I think that also goes along with what you were saying about the dichotomy that gets set up ideologically or philosophically amongst, like, you know, within the American society or the United States psyche, is that it's always, you know, and this is true about any culture, that, you know, it's very, you know, they're very myopic and they're very, you know, isolated in terms of how they view themselves,
right, very
and that a lot of this comparison between the U.S. culture and other cultures just what it would do is essentially kind of perpetuate the relative xenophobia that, that exists within this country, not necessarily in a way that is, you know, how would I say, I don't know, destructive, but it maintains itself,
right.
It
yeah.
perpetuates itself. But we actually have one more caller before we... Nope, they've disappeared. So thank you again. Thank you, everyone, for... Thank you, everyone, for participating in our discussion. Just so you know, and at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear about the story behind the Downing Street memo, and the director of the Al Jazeera demands more information on the secret memo about Bush's desire to bomb Al Jazeera. That's at 11. If you have any final comments before our live discussion is up, either of you?
Well, I just, you know, actually for the other side, one point I wanted to bring up, which is that, you know, culture is hybridized and it's constantly evolving. And so, you know, it's not static. And I think part of the discussion then too is, you know, how are we defining so-called American culture? You know, is it a kind of, sort of composite of sort of this rich history, and, you know, what gets excluded, et cetera, et cetera. But I just wanted to highlight and point out that it is hybridized.
I just want to say, I think, you know, when we talk about appreciation and appropriation, this issue, and I think it tends to put us, you know, the people, who, not only us, but other people who talk about it, that we, you know, that we really look are just all negative. So I just, you know, I think my, what I appreciate about discussions like this is just to try and raise awareness. You know, mm-hmm. when you're going to the store, I'm not saying, you know, obviously I'm not telling what people what to buy and what not to buy, but when you go to purchase something, I mean, just, you know, take a few more minutes or hop on the, I mean, the internet's a great tool, and just, you know, just heighten awareness. So that, you know, I think that's, you know, and maybe hopefully some change will come out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to Asian and Pacific American Compass. We're on every Friday but every first Friday of the month from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Thank you very much.
Not simple mathematics nor easy science. While my verses are my mind's poetic appliance, I don't write to limelight and slam competitions, seeking success and scores from showing off syllabic skills, nor am I trying to impress my creative writing teacher. Perchance, I may be collecting points for alliteration. No, my inspiration comes from hopes for better relations. Let me start the explanations. Some see this sister shortness. Suspect she sings songs subjected to flowers and daisies. Maybe envisioning or verbalize a voluble verse like, I am Mother Earth. I shall give birth to the seeds of the universe. No, that's not me, and don't expect love letter-like lines or lyrics liable to lip-locking and lust, but do trust that I'm just trying to get shit off my chest. You see, my time, like unpaid bills, was past due. So my poetry's my revolution, my resolution for liberation from assimilation and magazine spreads. Lies epitomize beauty as blonde hair and blue eyes when I am just the opposite, yet publicly painting my picture as lotus blossoms and dragon ladies. How can I evade these stereotypes made of me? How many times must you use the word exotic as adjective to how I live? Yellow fever's a big hit these days. Qigong and feng shui practice in every which way, and every once in a while there is the one who wishes to master my dialect and make me his oriental mistress, like some goddamn concubine who will rub his spine while transcribing his name to look like mine. Seems that so-called acceptance is achieved through simulating and simulated superficialities, so you take its pleas from my culture and cultivate it for commercial commodities. A shame it's so freely appropriated, arrogated, and confiscated when there was a time when such things were not so appreciated. Beginning with brothers laborers laying tracks for transcontinental transportation, but exclusion laws were instituted so that immigrants couldn't obtain American residence, return to the internment camps. No surprise, with yellow peril on the rise, we watch white actors tape their eyes and pearl as buck their teeth, uttering fortune cookie speech. And remember the days of elementary when roll call always mispronounced my nomination so that classmates chimed together for ching chong chants. This is the entity which defines my identity, my real reason for rhyming. If my flow's got good timing, I can actually hold a younger mind in its patience, disperse seeds of Asian American history, all in rhyming cadence, or at least grab another sister or brother to get poetically inspired, or at least to admire the identity unidentified by materialistic and unmaternalistic attire, nowadays caught on fire by desires of mainstream media mogul hip-hop culture liars. And though I might be preaching to the choir, the lesson is still to leave perceptions in different directions, not trying to place blame or reprehension. That's just your miscomprehension and you just not paying attention. Then you must not have followed me. My apologies for this convoluted, rhyme-polluted, I'm sorry your hat does not include philosophy. Possibly, you were just not ready for it.
Community calendar for Friday, February 3rd. Saturday, February 4th from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, Exhibit Hall C, celebrate the Lunar New Year at the Chinese New Year Cultural Fair. The fair will showcase performances including Chinese folk dance. Chinese delicacies will also be prepared and served. A free shuttle bus will be provided from Portland Community College's Southeast Campus. For information, call 503-771-9560. Or visit www.portlandchinesetimes.us. Saturday, February 4th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., also at the Oregon Convention Center, ballrooms 201 to 204, welcome the New Year of the Dog, as the Oregon Vietnamese Community Association presents TET 2006. Highlights of the event include a lion dance, art exhibits, cultural entertainment, and the Miss Vietnamese Beauty Pageant. There will also be a health education and prevention forum. For information, call 503-806-7384 or visit www.en.ovca-usa-org. February 8th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the State Office Building, Room 123, attend a community summit with the Korean American Citizens League. The event will focus on minority outreach issues in youth correctional facilities such as McLaren, one of the largest juvenile detention facilities in the nation. Advanced registration is requested. For information or to register, call 503-884-5607 or visit www.kacl.org.
This is Marie Lowe, and these are my Angry Asian Minutes. Today, I want to focus on a controversy that has been circulating here at KBOO Community Radio and on the Grassroots Radio Coalition listserv, which is made up of community radio activists. The controversy is around announcers with accents. The argument against announcers with accents is that they are difficult to understand and that in radio, audio quality is of primary importance. To all of you who have problems listening to accents, I have this request. Please don't use the word community in community radio, because how you define the word community does not include me. You should be specific and call it white standard English speaker community radio. Don't universalize your experiences by hiding under this undifferentiated banner of inclusion called community. This discussion is not about audio quality, and it is not about comprehension. This discussion about accents, and let's be honest, you're not talking about British accents, is about who belongs and who doesn't. For Asian Pacific Americans, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you speak without an accent because of a history of forced assimilation, discrimination, and pressure to fit in, you're complimented on how well you speak English. Such compliments erases the long history of Asians in North America. It tells us there's only one way to be American, and we're not it. We've only done a good job of mimicking real Americans. On the other hand, if you don't have a standard accent, well then, you're obviously foreign. You don't belong because you haven't successfully erased the traces of your past. You are dismissed as less professional, less intelligent, condescended to, and infantilized. You are a source of endless amusement for those who find your accent funny, but not on the radio. For all of you progressives who support notions of diversity but have difficulty with accents, let me say this. Diversity is not a one-way street. Diversity is not about putting the burden of inclusion on people already marginalized to assimilate and fit in. It's not about liking sushi, practicing feng shui, or wearing ethnic clothing. That's boutique multiculturalism. It feeds into a consumer culture that tells you how open-minded you are when you buy something different or date someone exotic. To truly support an equitable society means working towards giving up some of your privilege, your space, to make room for someone else. Because for those of us who are marked as outsiders, that is an everyday condition, that daily giving up of yourself to fit in, to accommodate others, taking less and less space till you blend in, become invisible, unaccented. I'd like to believe we're here in community radio because we hope we can embody what the larger society could be if the voiceless were given a voice, if we take seriously the commitment to listen to voices that don't always sound like our own. For community radio to truly be a community requires a radical imagination of what community looks like and what it sounds like.
you for listening to this edition of APA Compass. And special thanks to those vendors who took the time to speak with Collective members Jay and Pam. Today's show was produced by the APA Compass Collective. Please join us again next month, Friday, March 3rd, from 9 to 10 a.m. For more information on APA Compass, please go to www.apacompass.org or email us at apacompass@gmail.com.
Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 16th annual Cascade Festival of African Films from February 3rd through March 4th. This year's festival highlights include films from Angola opening and closing the festival, and an examination of the African legacy in Mexico through screening, symposium, and community conversation. Additionally, there will be a spotlight on AIDS in Africa, Women Filmmakers Week, and appearances by some of the directors at the film festival. For more information, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org or call 503-244-6111, extension 3630.
Jump if you get belay to Bhutan. Drink if you get belay to Tekan. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi. Enjoy yourself as you think you sabi.